presentation of A Novel Idea on KRCB.org is made possible by our members and by SolarWorks, helping homeowners, businesses, and communities conserve resources and save money for over 21 years. Information on going solar is available at SolarWorks Downtown Sebastopol office, 707-829-8282, or online at solarworksca.com.
Lilus tenía una amiga, Ciruelita, consentida y chiqueada. Ciruelita hablaba a los 11 años como en su más tierna infancia. Cuando Lilus volvía de Acapulco, su amiga la saludaba. ¿Qué tal te fue? ¿No te comieron los tiburonchitos esos felochichimos ololes? Semejante pregunta era una sorpresa para Lilus, que casi se había olvidado del modo de hablar de su amiga, pero pronto se volvía a acostumbrar. Todos sus instintos maternales se vertían en Ciruela con máxima adoración. Además, Lilus oyó decir por allí que las tontas son las mujeres más encantadoras del mundo.
Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host, and you've been listening to my guest, Elizabeth Martinez, who is chair of the Department of Chicano and Latino Studies at Sonoma State University. And she's been reading from a book called Lilus Quicus by Elena Poniatowska. Elena Poniatowska is not currently that well known in the United States, but Elizabeth and I are working on this because yes. She's a wonderful writer. And to hear the Spanish is like listening to music, Elizabeth.
Oh, yes.
It is.
I agree.
It's beautiful. And recently, Poniatowska was in Santa Rosa and spoke at Sonoma State to a capacity crowd and then at the Santa Rosa Library. And more than 200 people were eagerly awaiting her presence that night. And you presided and read some of her work in Spanish. Then she read and answered questions. And later you'll hear our interview with Poniatowska and also with Linda Egan of the University of California at Davis, the Department of Spanish and Portuguese. But in the beginning, it's Elizabeth and me talking together about Elena Poniatowska and her work.
Yes, and I'd just like to make the point that Linda Egan, who is a Latin American literature professor as I am, we worked together on this for a good 2-year period just to be able to get all of the entities involved and get money raised so that we could bring such a special speaker to our area. And at the Sonoma County Public Library there in Santa Rosa that evening, I think everyone was so surprised because it was more than standing room only, just the huge turnout of people eager to listen to this Mexican novelist and journalist.
Yeah. And I don't know when I've been in such a warm crowd. The affection in that room for Poniatowska, you could just feel the flow of it toward her, and I'm sure that she felt it.
Yes.
It was such a special evening, and I have the handicap of not speaking Spanish, so I could appreciate what it was for the people in the room for whom Spanish is their first language to have a very well-known writer from Mexico, a writer of more than 50 books of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, to come to Santa Rosa to read from her work and to speak to them in both to all of us, but especially to this people for whom Spanish is their first language.
Yes, we had set up for her to do, and she did do her readings first in English and then in Spanish. But what really surprised me was that the crowd there, not only native speakers of Spanish, but also native speakers of English who understood Spanish, they all begged for her to do more readings in Spanish.
That was very interesting.
Remarkable.
Wasn't it? And I think people could have stayed there all night.
Oh, yes.
Nobody wanted to leave.
We wore her out.
And she was so warm herself and so appreciative of the attention. She had the complete attention of that room full of people. And then we had the opportunity later to have an interview with her here in the studio, which our listeners will hear pretty soon. Mm-hmm. But I first learned of Elena Poniatowska from you, Elizabeth, in a course that you taught in the Lifelong Learning Institute at Sonoma State on Latina writers. And it was a new name to me. But, you know, I'm a provincial American. I don't know
no,
nearly
<you're>
enough about the literature of other nations. I'm learning a lot about the Canadian writers that we never hear about. And thanks to you, the Latina writers. And I think of the world of writers that I have yet to make a connection with. But when you talked about Poniatowska and her early work, Lilas Kukas, I was fascinated with it. And then when I found out that you were the translator and had at that time just received an award for your translation.
You were very kind.
I thought, I have to know more about about Elena Poniatowska.
It is the only novel I have translated.
Really?
Yes.
Now, how you have known of Poniatowska for a long time.
Yes, I have. In fact, my copy of Lilas Kukas in Spanish here has the autograph from the first moment that I met Elena, and I see it's 1992.
And tell us about the circumstances in which you met her.
Well, I was a graduate student. I was working on my doctoral degree at the University of New Mexico, Albuquerque, and she came in to do a lecture, and that was when I met her. I had already had the idea the previous year as part of my master's thesis. I did an evaluation of literature by Mexican women writers, and so I already had this idea that I would like for people who read in English to read this lovely story, Lilas Kukas. It is just a model example of irony, kind of between the lines message that is hilarious at times and very enjoyable.
It's a charming little book. And when you first see it, you think it might be a book for children because
yes.
of the illustrations and the the language. But then you realize that she's telling a story that's important for not only for children, but it's a universal story.
Something else that impressed me about it is that the book was published in 1954, and that is way ahead of any feminist anything, any women's movement. And yet this book, like a journalist, a good journalist often does, is that it makes commentary on society in somewhat subtle way. You have to really get into it to read it. I always feel like there's a first level reading that you can make and say, oh, how cute, this is darling. And then once you read it a second or third time, you think, what is she doing here? And that is what we enjoy reading.
And that's exactly the way I experienced it. The first time I read it, I thought, oh, that's a sweet little story. And then I read it again and I thought, There's a lot more here than I picked up on the first time through. I would certainly encourage our listeners to get a copy of Lilas Kukas as well as other books by Poniatowska. But Lilas Kukas is a good one to start on because it's not a long book and it's charming.
Elena's books really tell the story of Mexico. I think I said this in the introduction that night. She has always accurately captured, whether in journalism or in her fiction, what the Mexican people and society are going through. Sometimes it's focused on the women in society, but almost always the lower level, the undertrodden, as I would say. And I guess her most famous work is on the massacre in the Plaza of Tlatelolco in 1968 in Mexico City,
yes.
which is a journalistic book that consists of a lot of interviews and quotes from people who were involved, and those are contrasted with the official word from the government. Mm-hmm. But she has several books like that and even a novel based on Tina Modotti's life. Tina Modotti, the photographer who was with Edward Weston for a few years. She's well known in the United States. But this thick novel with the title Tinissima that Elena published really tells a story about from the 1920s through the 1940s, both in Mexico, a little in U.S., and a lot more in Spain and Italy, and a very interesting time of history.
And then her recent book that won the Gallegos Prize, is that the one about the railroad strike?
Yes, it is. The railroad workers' movement and strike in the 1950s. And what is interesting about that novel, and there are some between-the-lines humorous pieces there also, what she does there is really the buildup that led to 1968, as we all know, that didn't burst from nowhere. But in Mexico, from the time of the 1950s, the government began clamping down on workers and union movements and strikes, those kind of things. And people were being jailed. And so the rise among university students in the 1960s, one of their main principles was to let people out of jail who had been jailed for no reason since the 50s. Not for no reason, but with no specific thing they were accused of.
Yes. And I imagine that there are very few people in the United States who were aware
of course.
What was going on in Mexico. I don't know how many people in Mexico would have been aware. But through the medium of fiction, she brings these stories, which she novelizes the history so that the facts are there. But she presents it in a way that is easier for people to follow the story.
Yes, Elena's books, and she may not, it may be a reason why she has not been as well known until just recent years, or her novels have not been translated until recent years. She doesn't fit that genre of magical realism or maybe, as they tend to say, cooking books like Water for Chocolate. Those are all wonderful novels, but they're a different way to bring out a message. Yes. With Elena's books, sometimes I feel like they're philosophical, an analysis of something that happened in the past and why we do what we do to each other in our societies.
Yes. It's a very interesting genre and one that it takes tremendous skill, I
think.
And her career as a journalist probably gave her the working ability to bring the stories together in that way.
Well, in fact, what I find so remarkable about Lilus Kikus is that this was written by a woman who was 20 years old, who was trying to probably figure out what to do in life, what her career would be. I'm sure she was born already with a desire to write. But she takes this cute little thing that is a mock children's story with 12 neat short chapters, and she essentially analyzes how society brings up little girls, brings up women. And of course, this is the 50s, based on the 40s ideology, that you grow up to marry well and to be a good, obedient wife. And yet, she's on the cusp of times are changing. In fact, in the segment I was going to read from in English, you'll hear her commentary. Now that women are getting into other roles in society, we need more of those fresh, innocent little things that we had before. So I just find it so remarkable that she set a path for the book she would do in the future, knowingly or not, when she created Lilus Kikus.
She's really telegraphing what her career as a writer is going to be, and you were clever enough to see that when you read the story. This would be a good time for you to do the translation in English of the portion that you read at the beginning. And I think it's chapter 11 in the book, is that right?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
So it is the next to last chapter, and some of the earlier chapters, it's sort of a mock coming-of-age novel where we start out as a child and then we go through life, and as we become an adult, we have learned or we have been formed by society for what we will turn into. So the 11th chapter, by then perhaps some discoveries are being made. And I read from the first two paragraphs in Spanish at the beginning of the show, and here is how I translated it to English. Lilus had a friend, Chiruelita, who was pampered and spoiled. At the age of 11, Chiruelita still spoke baby talk. When Lilus returned from Acapulco, her friend greeted her. How it go? Didn't the sharkies bite you, those ugly bad fishies? Such a statement surprised Lilus, who had nearly forgotten her friend's way of talking. But she would soon get used to it again. All of her maternal instincts surged when she was with Chiruela, whom she dearly loved. Also, Lilus had heard it said that dummies are the most enchanting women in the world. That's right, those who know nothing, who are simply juvenile and absent. Of course, Chiruelita went a little overboard, but Lilus always forgave her, and she had all sorts of reasons and examples for her friend's behavior. After all, Geth, who was so intelligent, had a wife who was like a fresh and innocent little girl who knew nothing but was always happy. No one ever said that the Holy Virgin knew Greek or Latin. The Virgin simply stretches out her arms, she opens them like a little child, and gives herself completely. Lilus knows of the dangers that await those who attempt to speak well, and she would rather keep quiet. It is better to feel than to know. The women who listen and receive are like rivers swollen with rainwater. They deliver themselves as great waterfalls of happiness. This could seem an apology for dummies, but now that there are so many intellectual women who teach, direct, and govern, it is so healthy and refreshing to suddenly discover a Chiruelita who speaks of flowers, frights, perfumes, and little strawberry tarts. Chiruelita married at age 17 a languid and eccentric artist. He is a painter, and in the first few years, he feels very happy with all of the curious occurrences and inconveniences of life with a simple and smiling woman. She serves him salted tea and tells him every day the story of the little husband who got lost in bed, a story that always finishes in a wail, each time more difficult to console. But one day, Chiruelita greets her husband with a crown of flowers in her hair and clasps of butterflies and cherries behind her ears and whispers in her most melodious voice, "Hello, my widow goat, me the spring of Botticelli. Today I make no sup for you." Upon which, and with a languid gesture, the eccentric artist wrung her neck. Oh my.
Oh my. What an absolutely amazing chapter that is.
Yes.
There are so many levels of meaning there. And the irony in it is so beautifully presented that you could almost read right by it and not get it the first time.
That's true.
And then you have to go back again and say, wait a minute, there's a lot more going on here than I realized.
Yes.
Now, tell me about translating that chapter, because the words, for example, the baby talk, how did you select the English words to translate the baby talk?
You have to do a lot of thinking when you're doing a translation. I've spoken to other people who have done translations. It's really a lot of work, which is probably why I haven't done it previously. When I was doing a reading from this book in the library discussion groups, someone came to the group and started mentioning that she had no idea I had done the translation. And she started saying, I was reading it in English and Spanish, but I put the English down because all the translation was wrong. And so we all laughed, especially the couple of people who knew I had translated it. But it's very typical for someone to say this. And that is because we tend to expect a literal translation, but a literal translation does not work.
No.
As we all know, in Romance languages, the adjective usually follows rather than precedes, and a lot of other things happen. But in addition to not being able to literally string words one after another, we need to have an idea of the cultural setting. And I think you need to be familiar with both the culture that of the original language, which is the country of Mexico, especially in the 40s, 50s, and the culture of the language in which you wish to translate it. So when I encountered this that I just read from, I tried to capture phonetically what we're accustomed to hearing in baby talk, how children will insert one consonant for another.
And do you try to preserve the rhythm of her writing? And I mean, it's almost like poetry, and you detect a meter in it. And do you try to preserve that as well?
Yeah, she has a very lyrical style.
Yes.
In the book that I published with the translation of Lilus Kikus, I selected four additional stories, which
yes.
I translated. And in one of the stories, it is it's the thoughts going on in a woman's mind. And the entire story, which is probably a page and a half long, is one long sentence. And I wanted to preserve her idea, but in English, we don't tend to do that the same way you do in a Romance language. So I really grappled with that one for a while, but I ended up breaking it into two paragraphs and some sentences, and yet I was constantly reading things aloud, and I felt like that I did capture the sense of what is running through a person's mind, especially when you work yourself up into a frenzy.
When you are doing the translation, do you read aloud?
Oh, yes, quite often. It torments my cat just terribly, who likes to sit in my lap as I write. She gets very upset. One time this little paw came up and slapped my face, telling me to shut up. But I do like to read aloud. I often encourage students to read aloud. It's good practice, and it also helps you capture things that you may not if you're reading silently.
Mm-hmm. Although you're translating from Spanish, if this were a story from Spain, your translation would probably be quite different.
I do not think I could do that because I although I've been in Spain, I did not grow up there as I grew up in Mexico. And I did not spend a long enough period of time there to really understand the kind of things one would have gone through perhaps in the 50s if I was attempting to translate a story published there. But likewise, in Argentina, the experience would be different. In Colombia, Peru, I think that the only thing I could translate would be something from Mexico.
It's much different than just the language, it's the context.
Correct.
Yeah.
Translation is you have to be patient and willing to take the time. You cannot just translate overnight. Maybe we can do that occasionally for interpreting, maybe in the courtroom, but to take a literary work or any kind of intellectual piece of writing and really make it make sense, you've got to go over and over it.
I want to read a paragraph from your introduction to Lilas Quicus, and this is what you say. The character Lilas may seemingly accept defeat at the end of the novel, but Poniatowska the writer never does, a fact that becomes more and more evident in her subsequent stories and novels. Lilas Quicus is invaluable as a foreshadowing of the mature Poniatowska. It provides insight into her political inclinations and the beginning of an acute contemplation of gender and Mexican society. Readers should remember that it was written and published in the mid-20th century, an era not open to women stepping out of traditional roles. It reveals the budding talent of a woman who has become one of Mexico's greatest writers. What does it feel like to have your own words read back to you like that, Elizabeth?
Well, it's very kind of you, but I was sitting here thinking I am making that assessment, but I cannot really find the words to state how impressive a figure she is.
Yes.
Whether it's a feminist person, she is someone who, people don't realize this, but she was a single parent. She became pregnant at age 20, and she was a single parent for many years before she married the person who was her husband. She had two other children. She's been a widow now for 10 years. But she remarkably went on to build a journalistic career. There are many photos where her oldest son is beside her, a six-year-old boy, and she went out to places and did things as a single parent. She also has persevered. She is the only person who was able to find a way around government censoring to get a book out 3 years later, but on the 1968 massacre. She has persevered in a way that few writers are able to, and some journalists and writers in Mexico have been assassinated, have been killed, and there is always that danger. In recent years, she came out in favor of the presidential candidate who is not president now, and there were people who terribly critiqued her and phoned her home and made death threats and all kinds of things that were happening, and she has still persevered. She is just such a remarkable woman that she has persevered, that she has put out so many books in her lifetime and yet raised a family. She's a very loving mother and grandmother. And I do not think I can even find good enough assessment for the contribution she has made.
Perhaps this is some of what I was picking up that evening in the library, the air of almost reverence toward her from the people in the audience, because she had their absolute attention.
They know she speaks for Mexico.
Yes, yes. And it was, I wouldn't have missed that evening for anything. I think about the way that she was received, almost worshipful.
Yes.
She wouldn't like that word.
Yes, and she's She's always so gracious with autographs. You notice people are standing in line for an hour and a half afterward for autographs.
Right.
She will sit there and let people take photos with her and do autographs. Anytime she's ever made an appearance, I've seen her sit there for a long period of time doing autographs.
What a lovely woman.
Claro que Chiruelita se pasaba un poco de la raya, pero Lilu sabía siempre disculparla y no le faltaban razones y ejemplos. Get, tan inteligente, tuvo como esposa a una niña fresca e ingenua que nada sabía pero que siempre estaba contenta. Y nadie ha dicho jamás que la Santísima Virgen supiera griego o latín. La Virgen extiende los brazos, los abre como un niño chiquito y se da completamente. Lilu sabe cuántos peligros aguardan a quien trata de hablar bien y prefiere callarse. Es mejor sentir que saber. Las mujeres que escuchan y reciben son como los arroyos crecidos con el agua de las lluvias que se entregan en una gran corriente de felicidad. Esto puede parecer una apología de las burras, pero ahora que hay tantas mujeres intelectuales que enseñan, dirigen y gobiernan, es de lo más sano y refrescante encontrarse de pronto con una chiruelita que habla de flores, de sustos, de perfumes y de tartaletitas de fresa.
We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we'll hear the interview with Elizabeth Martinez and Linda Egan and Elena Poniatowska herself, and we'll be talking more about her work and her life. So we'll be right back. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host, and I have guests with me in the studio this evening. My guests are Elena Poniatowska from Mexico, a journalist, an author of more than 50 books. Now, what an impressive number. It's such an honor to have you here.
Thank you very much, Rosie. Thank you.
And also with us, Elizabeth Martinez of the Sonoma State Faculty. Elizabeth is chair of the Department of Chicano and Latino Studies and has been my guest before, so she's a familiar voice to you. So glad to have you here, Elizabeth.
Thank you for your invitation.
Yeah. And also with us is Linda Egan from University of California at Davis, who describes herself as a Mexicanist. So I'm really eager to hear the contributions of all three of you. I'm so glad you're here.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
It's through Elizabeth that I came to know your work, Elena, and I'm so grateful to Elizabeth for that. I took her course in Latina writers at Sonoma State in the Lifelong Learning Institute, and she was one of the writers that she introduced us to, and she said that perhaps someday you'd be coming to Sonoma County. And yeah. So here we are, yeah. And I'm delighted with that. And, of course, Elizabeth has also been your translator of the book Lilas Kikus that we'll be talking about and was honored for her translation. And speaking of honors, Elena, you have a very, very impressive new honor in the prize that you've just been awarded. In addition, you've had a Guggenheim Fellowship, an Emeritus Fellowship from Mexico's National Council of Culture and Arts. You were the first woman to win Mexico's National Award for Journalism in 1979. You probably have a string of first woman to do this and first woman to do that. And you've just received another very important prize, the Romulo Gallegos Prize. I'm going to ask Elizabeth if she'll tell us about the significance of the award, because I'm afraid you might be too modest.
Yes, thank you. I'd love to point that out. Elena is indeed only the second woman, female person, to receive this prestigious award. I think of it as the Pulitzer among Latin American literary awards, and people are selected from among all Latin American countries. the Romulo Gallegos is named for a president of Venezuela, early 20th century president, and his first name was Romulo, last name Gallegos, and the award has carried his name through the years. And I just want to make the point that the award, since it's named for a Venezuelan president and the funding was set up there, the award is always made, it is formally presented in the country of Venezuela, and it actually has nothing to do with the current or any presidents. It just so happens that the award is delivered to someone there. So in August, Elena traveled to Venezuela to receive this award. The people who compete from it are big name authors from throughout Latin America, but their work is a blind entry, and from that, the best person is selected, the best novel. Mm-hmm. And Elena's novel that won this award is her most recent novel, El Tren Pasa Primero, The Train Comes Through First, or something like that. And it is not yet in English translation, but hopefully will be sometime soon. The previous female writer to receive this award was also a Mexican, Ángeles Mastretta, who is an excellent writer. But Elena Poniatowska is probably the best big-name writer, and there are some excellent writers that were coming up second, third in the running, but she is the one who was selected.
Well, we'll certainly watch for the translation of that book, and those of our listeners who speak Spanish are the most fortunate because you can buy the book in Spanish and read it while the rest of us are waiting for the translation. So congratulations to all the Spanish speakers. I'm so envious of those who are fluent in other languages, and always admire that facility. I want to talk first a bit about your life and work, Elena. And again, I invite Elizabeth and Linda to join in because I'm sure you know more about Elena than I do. Elena, your first language was French.
My first language, yes, was French because my father was French of Polish origin, and my mother was Mexican, but she was born in Mexico. She was born in Paris, and her mother was also born in Paris. Mm-hmm. They all left Mexico during the Mexican Revolution because they lost all their land, their haciendas. Emiliano Zapata took away their land, and so they went to Paris.
Yes. And how old were you when you returned to, when you first came to Mexico?
I was between 9 and 10 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
I was 10 years old in the boat.
Your birthday on the boat.
Yeah.
I found this in Contemporary World Writers talking about you. Her position as an outsider in Mexican society has given her freedom as both an observer and a writer, and she has used it to great effect in her work.
Oh.
I think being an outsider is an ideal situation for a writer, but it's not always comfortable for the person who's going through it. What was your childhood like? Did you easily fit into the new culture? Or
yes, because I immediately went to an English school called the Windsor School, where we used to sing God Save the Queen. And then I went to, God Save the King. No, it was a queen. And then afterwards, I learned how to count in pounds, shillings, and pence. So I never felt like an outsider because children learn a language very quickly.
That's true.
And I learned Spanish. My sister and I, we learned Spanish, I think, in less than 2 months.
Amazing.
So we were speaking because I think it's very easy when you're a child. You should learn all languages when you're very young.
I couldn't agree more. And I think it's a tremendous flaw in the educational system in the United States that we don't teach languages to young children. Because, as you say, that's the time to learn them.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Here, another quote from Contemporary World Writers, again about you. She has been most influential in her books of testimony, which have shown the continuing oppression and poverty which characterizes the lives of many in Mexico, especially women from the lower classes. How is it that you came to write, particularly to be a champion of women of the lower classes?
But it's not only women, it's also men.
Of course.
And of course, children and people. But usually women are very badly treated in Mexico. They're mistreated. They usually, no one takes care of them or no one believes in them. And I think they're a very important element in Mexican society because they usually raise their children, the children they have, and then the children that come near to them, or they call in Mexico, they say entenados, the huérfanos, the orphans and children who don't have a mother. And they usually ask or they want for these children what they never got for themselves. They're very generous, so they're willing to work very hard in order to give a future to so these children can go even to the university. So this is one of the reasons that women in Mexico, Mexican women, are very outstanding, because besides all of them work. They work, and a person who works has its own dignity, no, or her own dignity, no.
Yes, and in your work, you bring out the dignity which they find in their own situations. There's a nobility that you find in your characters that I think is very appealing to the reader. Another author might not have seen that, but I think you have a passion for justice. Would you agree?
Well, I hope so.
Yes.
I hope, but I have also a passion for women because I think they're so outstanding in my country, and they have so few opportunities. No.
Yes.
Yes.
You got your start in journalism, and you're described as one of the most skilled interviewers in the world. I wonder if you'd share any of your secrets about your success at interviewing.
I don't have many secrets. When I started, I was very, how do you say it? Impertinente. How do you say it in English?
Impertinent.
Yes, I was really, because I knew absolutely nothing I went to school in a convent in Eden Hall, in a Catholic school, near Tarsdale, in a little town called Tarsdale in Philadelphia, no? So that's where I learned my English. Well, first in the Windsor School and then in Philadelphia. And as I knew absolutely nothing about the person I was interviewing, I asked very personal questions, no? For instance, I would say, why do you have such a big stomach? Or why does your hair stand out? Or why are you baby teeth, or things like that? And I would ask those stupid questions to very important people. So as time went by, usually the people who read the newspaper would say, well, let's see what this stupid girl is going to ask. No, what is she? She's going to be really crazy. What she's going to ask? So, this is how it all started. I had sort of a reputation for being, no, I don't know if stupid, but very
cheeky,
very polite, not cheeky. The word isn't cheeky, but it is not being very polite or conventional.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yes. And you were very young when you started doing this.
Yes, I was 20.
Yes, and physically you're small, and I think that is also can work for an interviewer because you're and you were described as cute, which must drive you crazy. But it worked for you in interviewing to have this. You used all your talents.
Well, you make me feel like Shirley Temple, but I wasn't. I was really a young girl, and I was afraid of what I was doing. So maybe that's why I asked so many impertinent questions, no? When you're afraid, you do whatever crazy things, no, that come into your head.
That's true. And you developed some of those interviews into books. Gabby Brimmer, a woman with cerebral palsy. Was she based on a real, an actual woman?
Yes. She, and then there was a movie done afterwards by Liv Ullmann, who was acted as Gabby Mothers, and then a very wonderful woman actress from Argentina called Norma Alejandro, who did the official story. And they did this movie in Mexico for Gabby Brimmer, and I think the book was quite successful and the movie also. But I didn't like the movie too much.
I was going to ask you, in general, how you feel about the movies that have been made from your work.
Well, not so many movies have been made, so I can't have a very large range of judgment. Mm-hmm. But, for instance, there's one that's called You Come By Night, Esmeralda, which is the story of a nurse who goes to the hospital 5 days, 5 nights a week. And she's always saying that she's at the hospital, but she really has 5 different husbands. And she sleeps with each one every night. So they made a movie of this, and they added about 200 more husbands. So at least, well, not 200, but at least 5 more, at least 10 husbands. So it was quite a critical situation for this woman who was judged for bigamy.
Yes, that's the story that's in the Lila Kikus book.
It's called You Come By Night.
I see.
Lila Kikus is a little girl.
Actually, I put the story in the book that I published.
Oh, you did.
The translation I did of Lilus Kikus wasn't quite long enough for U.S. publishers to want to publish as a book. So I asked them if they would publish it if we added 4 stories.
Yes.
And that is one of the stories that I chose because it's just incredible. A story that came out in the 70s about a woman who has 5 husbands who tells the judge, well, you know, no way I could sleep with them if I wasn't married to them. And it's just the irony there is just drippingly incredible. And in my mind, the movie does nothing for the story. In fact, it invents some additional ideas. But the story is one of the most powerful for irony of all of Elena's stories.
Well, it's my favorite story. And I'm going to tell our readers, you know, how to find the book and how to get the book and to make sure that they know that these 4 wonderful, very short stories are in there. But I thought that story was just genius because you did the gender switch in which the things that men were allowed to get away with, the woman was persecuted for them. And you did it in such a breezy and brilliant way that it was, you know, it was perfect. I love that story.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about your book, Massacre in Mexico. You'll forgive me for using the English with all of these. My Spanish pronunciation is not strong, and Spanish is such a beautiful language, I, you know, hesitate to mess
it up. Could I throw in a comment? Tlatelolco is actually Nahuatl, not Spanish. Sometimes we forget that there are a lot of indigenous words or vocabulary in the Mexican language.
Ah, and you learned colloquial language, I think, from the servants when you were young?
I learned Spanish in the streets.
Ah.
And I listened, I used to listen to how the people in the streets talked and the people who worked at the house and came to the house talked, mostly people who did services, you know, the carpenters or the mailman or the milkman. Usually, many years ago, the milk was delivered at your door, and I used to speak to all of them, and they had the most wonderful Spanish you can hear, and the most wonderful poetic words. Yes. And this was very, for me, it was a way of acquiring a language, because in my house with my mother, my mother and grandmother, we spoke mostly French. We didn't speak a lot of Spanish. And that's how I learned Spanish.
I see. Uh-huh. But that makes me think of your character, Lila Kikus, who was rather unconventional little girl and didn't like to play with dolls and preferred to be out on the street, watching the life of the street and learning about how the world worked. So is there some of you in that little girl?
Yes, there is, of course, and some of my sister, but usually children, they always want to be in the streets. In Mexico also, very small children, they say, calle, 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 which means I want to go to the street. Because, of course, in the street, you're very distracted. No, you can see so many things that you never see if you stay closed in your room or closed in your house.
Of course. And in the book, Lila Kikus, as you take your character through the different stages in her growing up, it's a classic coming-of-age story, but it kind of sneaks up on you. The first time I read it, I thought, oh, that's sweet. And it is sweet. But then as you examine it further and watch the development of this little girl, and then in the translation that Elizabeth did, your wonderful prologue that you wrote to is especially helpful for people like me who miss a lot of the fine points because I don't have that much knowledge of either the language or the country. And so between, it was kind of a guide to the book.
I'm glad.
Oh, I found it extremely helpful and made me get a more a wider view of what you were saying in telling the story of this adorable little girl. Yeah.
I'm glad you find her adorable.
I did.
I don't know if my mother did.
Well,
I'm glad you do.
If I was her mother, I might not have found her adorable either. But her curiosity and her openness and her willingness to try different things and her she was a courageous young woman, I thought, as we went through time with her and she became a young woman. Did you write Lilas Kukas as a book for children or young people?
No, I wrote it. No one would read it. I remember persecuting my mother or my father in order to ask them if they wanted to sit down and read it, but they didn't. And then they never had time. Grown-ups usually never have time, no? So afterwards I took it. There was a Mexican writer called Juan José Arriola. He started with Lilas Kukas a collection called Los Presentes. And I remember he told me that he wasn't interested at all in journalism, that he wouldn't work with me if I brought him interviews or journalism because it wasn't. But if I had something else or I had written something else, he would read it and maybe publish it. Oh, well, he started the publishing house after he read this book. So when I brought him Lilas Kukas, he said he would publish it. And it started a collection called Los Presentes. And Carlos Fuentes published there his first book. And José Emilio Pacheco published there his first book. And many, Alvaro Mutis, many writers who are now celebrated, started in this collection called Los Presentes.
Wonderful. And then Elizabeth translated it so we English speakers could have the pleasure of reading it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the process of translation because it fascinates me. And I understand that you are a translator as well. You've translated other people's work. So you've done this from both sides as the author and the translator and Elizabeth as well. But to me, it's the process is almost magical to determine what it is that the author is saying, to find the way to say that in another language. Can you tell me a little bit about how that works? Where you start? Do you sit down together and say, this is what I had in mind? Or how does it work? Elizabeth?
Well, I can address my decision to translate Lilas Kukas. It's something that I do not remember at what point in my life I read it, but during the period of time I was working on my master's degree in literature in Hispanic letters, I found it, I have always especially enjoyed works written by women, and I found it just, anyone who reads it sees it's such an example, it's such an excellent example of irony. And so I wanted to do something with it, but in order to, what I did was work this into the thesis for my master's degree, but in order to write the kind of thesis I wanted to write, I needed to translate it so that the people would get a full understanding of it. And in the process of translating it, I thought, you know, this is so remarkable that people who only read in English should be able to read this. I'd like to publish it someday. Well, of course, that was a good more than 10 years before I actually would be able to publish it. And I ended up reworking it through the years, and it became a much better translation than it was during my master's thesis. Uh-huh. But that is how I came upon this idea. In recent years, I'll just add to what you were commenting on earlier, is that I have this theory now as an older professor, I have this theory that well-known writers who have published a lot of books, that we can learn a lot about them or sort of see the type of writing career they will have by reading their first book. And that is what I feel about Lilus Kikus for Elena Poniatowska. You can see her great known journalism works in it. You can see the irony for all of her creative works, her between the lines political message. You can see all of that in Lilus Kikus. So that to me made it a very valuable piece of work that I wanted to see in publication. And originally I had approached the University of New Mexico Press and they were very interested in it. At first they were, I think they were more interested in the Leonora Carrington drawings, which
oh, the lovely
Elena
drawings,
herself
yes.
has said that's what makes the book most valuable. I don't
yes.
agree, but they are indeed exquisite.
But they're wonderful, right?
And in fact, they were created by Leonora Carrington very early before she became a famous artist.
Amazing.
And she did this as a friend to Elena, an older friend, and gave them to her, so the drawings do belong to Elena.
Yeah.
But at some point, much later, many years later, I contacted the University of New Mexico Press again, and they were still interested. And at that point, I was in touch with Elena, and she was willing. She has always been very gracious in helping those of us who work on something about her work, and so that is how the translation came about.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in the colloquial words that you have. In the first chapter, Lilus Toys and Distractions, I came across this sentence. Lilus believes in witches and sews into her britches a little sprig of fine herbs. Now, britches, what a cute word. And of course, I wanted to know, now, I wonder what that original word was. And do you use a thesaurus or how do you do this?
I think the original word is calzones, is it, Elena? That would be, I grew up in Mexico, so it seems to me that is what it would be, which means britches. It's kind of a colloquial way of saying underwear or whatever, underpants, perhaps it would be. But as a translator, once you have more experience, you know you do not do a literal word-for-word translation, but you try and get the essence of the cultural meaning, the colloquial meaning into the translation. And I can give an example by that, something that perturbed me for a long time, and I had to do research by interviewing a lot of people. And I was asking, what is a song young women as children sing as they jump rope or something like that, a refrain, something like that? Because Elena has, at some point in a chapter in Lilus Kikus, Elena had naranja dulce, limón partido, dame un abrazo que yo te pido, which if I translate that literally, you know, sour lime, sweet orange, it doesn't make sense. And at some point I found that a refrain that is used upon jumping rope is Cinderella dressed in yellow went downstairs to meet a fella. So I ended up using that. And of course you could say, well, that doesn't make sense. You know, we don't say Cinderella in Mexico. But it got the essence that she is attempting to communicate with what the little girl was doing in her play.
And so that's what the translator looks for.
Yes.
The essence.
And that is what the critics remark on, what makes a good translation, is when you can get that feel of culture and experience come alive.
It takes a lot of skill, a lot of time.
Yeah, if I could add,
yes.
Jill Levine is a very well-known translator who is based at UC Santa Barbara. She has written books on the art of translating, and it is an art. And a translator is almost an author in his or her own right. She has translated a lot of Severo Sardui's work, and he's an extremely difficult neo-Baroque writer. Also Lezama Lima and Cabrera Infante. Some of these are some of the most difficult, linguistically difficult writers that there are. And for her to tackle a gringa, for her to tackle translating these guys, very difficult. She practically has to be an author to write their novels. Mm-hmm. And so her Elizabeth's point about using the Cinderella song is absolutely spot on.
Yes. Yes, I think Elizabeth's translation was very, very good and very creative, mm-hmm. very accurate and very creative also, because I remember many, many years ago, there was a translation in Argentina of Shakespeare. There's a part where Shakespeare says about someone, let him play his own music. And it was translated into Spanish, déjelo que tome sus lecciones de piano, let him take his piano lessons. So the translator did much too much. No one had said anything about piano lessons, and imagine in Shakespeare's time, no? So this was, Elizabeth was very accurate. She is very accurate, very precise, no? And she doesn't betray the writer in any way, no. So she did a very beautiful, creative translation, no.
She kept the beauty of the language.
Mm-hmm. I think yes. She made it more beautiful than it is goodness. In Spanish.
I think I'm going to cry. The magnificent Elena Poniatowska saying this.
That's right. We're under time constraints, so we're going to have to cut our conversation short. I wish we had another hour because the three of you, you know, there are dozens of things I'd love to talk with you about. But I appreciate so much that you could take the time from your busy day to come in and talk with us. And it's just been such a pleasure.
Could Linda and I add a couple of recommendations to people to read from Elena?
Oh, please.
I very much recommend the translation of her novel on Tina Modotti's life. The title is Tinissima. And as I was stating last night at the presentation that Elena did, if we read that novel, and this is true of the majority of Elena's books, we do not simply learn about Tina Modotti. We also learn an awful lot about Mexico, especially in the very important first half of the 20th century. And it is such an exquisite way to get to know Elena's special turns of phrase and the way she describes society and people's innermost thoughts. Mm-hmm. I recommend that. I also recommend the translation of her previous award-winning novel prior to the recent one, and that is The Skin of the Sky, La Piel del Cielo, which when I did a book review, I stated that the main character is not so much a person as science in Mexico and why bureaucracy takes over and doesn't help young scientists, sort of the state of science during the 20th century. I very much recommend those two excellent books.
Linda?
Well, I would recommend Nothing and Nobody for you to get a sense of her chronicle style. I wish there were a translation. Maybe I'm going to have to do one. Fuerte es el Silencio, because that is a book that contains four or five magnificent chronicles of some of the most transcendent issues in Mexico yesterday and today. But the chronicle Nothing, Nobody of the earthquake time, this collage of voices is wonderful and captures Mexico at a time when it is learning what it is to be a democracy, learning what it is to think for oneself and to act autonomously without the government telling you what to do.
These are marvelous recommendations.
I wish you would read the next book I'm going to write, or the book I'm starting to write. But I never, for instance, Nothing, Nobody, it's called Strong as a Silence. I always, when people ask me which is the book I like that I've written, I always say Strong as a Silence, but not because I think it's good, but because Carlos Monsiváis told me he thought it was good. Imagine. So I don't have a good judgment on what I do. I never know when it's good or bad. Well, maybe I know when it's bad because I usually think it's very bad. But I never really have a critical idea of what I write.
Has Fuertes el Silencio been translated?
And Fuertes el Silencio has been translated into German and Chinese.
But not English.
But not in English.
Okay.
And I would also like to make note that anyone who has ever listened to Elena has heard her sound this way. She is extremely humble. I do not understand why myself, because she is as great a writer as Carlos Monsiváis, Carlos Fuentes, Octavio Paz. She is one of our greatest writers of the 20th century and now the 21st century. And any of her works that we read, and hopefully several of them, we learn an awful lot about Mexico and Latin America.
Yes. Well, it's a great honor to have you here.
Thank you.
And wonderful
Thank you, Rosemary.
To talk with the three of you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation with Elena Poniatowska, journalist and author of more than 50 books, including Lilas Kikus and Other Stories, which was translated into English by my guest Elizabeth Martinez of the Faculty of Sonoma State. Linda Egan of the University of California at Davis was also a part of the conversation, and we thank you all for sharing your precious time with us. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. Suzanne Lang produces the show. Thanks for listening, and remember that KRCB presents a literary program every Wednesday evening at 7. Don't forget, there's no such thing as too many books.